Hello and welcome to Asia in Depth. I'm Michelle Flor Cruz. North Korea has long resisted foreign influence, aggressively guarding its borders and ruthlessly controlling information coming in and out of the country. But have they managed to keep their country free from the great intruder of 2020, the deadly coronavirus? The country reportedly took quick action early to ban foreign visitors and impose long quarantines, recognizing the risk of an epidemic. But with widespread poverty and a weak public health system, even North Korean officials have acknowledged that a major outbreak would be disastrous for the country. In the midst of this came North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's unexplained disappearance for nearly 3 weeks and sudden reappearance. Should Kim at some point no longer be able to lead, who, if anyone, is next in line? And how can we assess the stability of the nation's leadership and its public health vulnerability? In this episode of Asia in Depth, Asia Society Policy Institute Vice President for International Security and Diplomacy Daniel Russell explores these questions with two experts on North Korea. Harvard Medical School scholar Dr. Ki-B Park, who leads an effort to assist doctors in North Korea, and Brookings Institute Senior Fellow Dr. Jung H. Pak, an author and former Deputy National Intelligence Officer at the National Intelligence Council. Russell begins the conversation by discussing the recent conflicting reports on Kim Jong-un's health.
I think we just have to start with the issue that has had everybody in a tizzy for the last couple of weeks, namely Kim Jong-un's disappearance. And I'll do just a quick refresh. You know, he was last sighted in public when he attended the major political meeting of the year in Pyongyang on April 11. That's the Supreme People's Assembly. But then he seemed to drop out of sight. There was a missile test on the 14th. That's the sort of thing that Kim Jong-un typically has liked to show up for. He skipped that. Much more significant was the fact that he was absent from the important Day of the Sun anniversary event the next day. That's the big national holiday marking the birthday of Grandpa Kim Il-sung, the person that Kim Jong-un has really modeled his own political image on. So it was conspicuous. And then later on, he missed another big deal celebration on the 25th, the anniversary of the Korean People's Army. And in the meantime, a South Korean defector news site published a report claiming that Kim had had a cardiovascular event or procedure that opened up a floodgate of rumors. He's dead, he's gravely ill, and so on. But then, lo and behold, on May 1st, the official North Korean news agency issued a report that he had made an inspection at a fertilizer plant and then posted some photos of Kim to prove it. So, Keith, I mean, since you're a physician, let me just start with you. And now, I'm kind of assuming that you don't have, you're aligned straight into Kim's medical records, although if I'm wrong, we're all ears. But like, the Kim family has a history of heart disease, right? Just looking at the Supreme Leader, kind of shudder to think what Kim Jong-un's BMI, might look like. So what, if anything, do we know, can we reasonably guess about Kim's physical condition? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear, right? He does have elevated risk factors. I mean, he's got family history, his body habitus, and he smokes and apparently drinks heavily. These are all adding to the risks. But, and I don't have a direct line into, his medical records. And North Koreans are masters at controlling information and managing it. And what we don't know is what we don't know. I mean, this news, the Daily NK news piece, in Korean, they describe the story as that the leader had a procedure, 시술 was the Korean word that they used. Well, the next day they published the English version, and they translated that to an operation, a surgery, 수술, right? So that's a huge difference. One's a procedure, a stent, something like that. You go home the next day or 2 days later. But the other one, 수술, as an operation, which is an incision with suturing and all kinds of big production. So That little translation led to a lot of speculation. At the end of the day, we only know what the North Korean government really wants us to know. So, yeah, that's that's all I can say.
Well, I mean, it was also a global game of telephone too, right? It was from North Korea to South Korea to the U.S. to Europe to TMZ to, you know, to Reuters and all of, you know, it went all ricocheted all across the globe with these little nuggets of, you know, some probably have some truth in them, but, you know, in this global game of telephone, a lot of it got distorted and, you know, it's so that it's really hard to decipher what the actual truth is.
Right. Well, one of the sort of reverberations was the speculation that Kim Jong-un may have come down with the coronavirus, and that accounted for his absence. Ki, how unlikely or plausible does that strike you?
Well, they do have diagnostic capabilities if they wanted to test someone to confirm, but once again, we don't know. Total speculation.
Yeah. Well, not knowing and total speculation are two concepts that are permanently linked to North Korea, I'm afraid. But you would have a sense of kind of what sort of medical care Kim Jong-un would get. And, you know, also for the elites, or certainly, you know, for the leader himself, what kind of role might foreign doctors play?
Right. So there was a situation where I think the Kim Jong-il had a stroke, and there was a story about a French neurosurgeon traveling to North Korea for that. And I think the jury's still out on that, whether that actually happened or not. There's some conflicting reports and changing the story. Yeah, and then I want to go back to the story again, because when I first read it, they talked about a clinic in Hyangsan, small town outside of Pyongyang, where he had a cardiovascular procedure. And I'm like, so to do that, even if you put in a stent, for instance, you need to have a full suite of live X-ray machines. We call it angiography rooms. And you need to also have backup in case the procedure goes wrong to do an open operation. I can't imagine that they would try something like that. First, you have to do an angiogram, a diagnostic catheterization to see where the vessel is blocked, and then have the technology and the equipment and the supplies to actually deploy a stent. And when I read the story that they did this in a small clinic in Hyangsan, in North Korea, I just found that to be hard to believe.
That makes a lot of sense.
What did you think, Jung?
You know, the thing about all of the rumors that were going around is that they're entirely plausible, you know, but you're the one who, you know, who could point out that it would be impossible to do that kind of major surgery in this little in this little clinic. But, you know, there are lots of stories about COVID plausible, right? Heart disease or some sort of surgical incident, also very plausible given what we know and what we can see about Kim's physical well-being. The rumors about a team of Chinese doctors going in, they all have some element of plausibility, but, you know, they all point in different directions. And that's something that for me, this latest incident, you know, coming out, the stories about Kim's absence coming out right when the book was coming out, I start the book with how you have all these different pieces of the puzzle, but you don't even know if they belong to the same puzzle. And this is a prime example of how difficult it is, the level of fragmentary information that you can have on North Korea that makes it really difficult to see inside or to glean with any specificity or a high confidence level on what the actual truth is. And this is something Dr. Park has also pointed out about. We just don't have much insight into Kim's actual top leader's health, which is not unusual for North Korea, but it's usual. It's not uncommon in other countries as well.
Well, Jung, I want to come back to that, but you know, the metaphor of a puzzle or a Rubik's cube is one that crops up a couple of places in your book. And I found it a very kind of helpful frame for thinking about what it was that you did for a living as an analyst, but also what we're all trying to do with so many different dimensions of North Korea. Now, there are two other theories about Kim's disappearance that I favor, of course. One is that this was really a book publication stunt that you and the North Koreans cooked up just to raise even more buzz about your book. The timing is highly, highly suspect. The other is that Kim Jong-un, who we all know is a huge Michael Jordan basketball fan, was holed up in a villa with Dennis Rodman watching The Last Dance, binge watching it on Netflix or something.
But you know, Dennis Rodman said that he didn't know where Kim was or how he was doing. So yeah. More elaborate than you might think, maybe.
Right. But one thing that was pointed out to me that may or may not mean anything, but in the, you know, in the vein of clues and random pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, is that, you know, in the Supreme People's Assembly meeting, the last time Kim was cited, his sister, Kim Yo-jong, was elevated into the Politburo. And so it raises the question, was there a clue there? You know, could that mean something? You know, is that some sort of an insurance policy, perhaps, because they knew that Kim Jong-un was, say, going to go under the knife or so. I admit that that's pretty speculative. But, you know, your book mentions Kim's health as one of the many big unknowns for North Korean experts and analysts. But, Jung, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you think we do know about the leader's health, and, you know, without getting into sources and methods, as they like to say, how do we know that kind of stuff about foreign leaders like Kim Jong-un?
You know, the way we find out about health is with people who have actually met the person, right? Where you do where you can assess, you know, either visually or physically, to see, you know, what kind of shape this person might be. What the effect of, you know, after having shunned foreign leaders for the first 6 years of his rule, Kim Jong-un in the past 2 years has really come out and had multiple summits with regional leaders as well as the U.S. president. We could see how he was walking without the time delay of the regime media or without the, you know, filters of regime media. We can see in real time how he was walking. We can hear him wheezing. We can hear him straining to a certain extent to walk a short distance. I thought if anything out of the summits that at least we could at least observe his situation and his condition at those particular moments. But we have to be careful too in extrapolating big conclusions from snapshots of that particular moment or of that particular event. Intelligence analysis, and especially North Korea, is really difficult because you have to see change over time, see the minuscule changes over time in the manner of speech or the locations of things or the way who's sitting closer to Kim of all things. It takes a really careful eye, as Dr. Park knows, about on how to read North Korea and to try to glean any sort of insights that we can use for actionable policies. A good friend of mine at the agency, Danny, who said, you know, leadership analysis is like working for People magazine. That you talk to a doctor who knows a doctor about this particular procedure that may or may not have been done on some, you know, celebrity. So on health issues specifically, on something as very personal as a leader's health or any individual's health, you know, that is really one of the biggest black boxes of analysis, whether it's intel or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like defectors who most of whom still have considerable lines into North Korean society and so on, offer a pretty valuable window into what's going on, including potentially things pertaining to, you know, a crisis of health or another form of crisis affecting the leadership. But I noticed that probably the most prominent North Korean defector, Tae Yong-ho, was one of the people absolutely convinced that Kim Jong-un was on death's door. And so it's kind of noteworthy to me that people like that, despite having close lines into North Korea, would get it so basically wrong.
He apologized for, you know, now that he's an elected member of the National Assembly, you know, subsequently he apologized for his statements. I mean, I don't know if that was necessary, but I think it goes to the difficulty of finding out information. And I think we have to, you know, what I remind some people who ask me is that just because it's intelligence or just because it's a defector speaking doesn't mean that it's true. Because sources lie, believe it or not. And it also depends on, you know, when we look at sources, we have to figure out their credibility and their access, right? This could be somebody who was near the leader or near the hospital or the clinic, but would not be a medical professional who would be able to speak in detail or have or be able to filter out the right information from the wrong information in the way that, you know, not everybody that who might speak about North Korea's nuclear weapons program would have that technical knowledge to be able to decipher whether one is solid fuel or the other is, you know, or liquid fuel ballistic missiles. So it really depends on not just who's, I mean, it depends on who's saying it, but also their access levels and their particular and their very specific access to levels to, of what they're actually talking about.
Well, that's a good insight and a good cautionary note. We got to get to COVID, but before we do, I just have to ask, Jung, I have to ask you about the succession. Like, what would have happened if Kim Jong-un had croaked? I mean, again, I realize this is the Rubik's Cube, but is there a scenario, a succession scenario that you would find, you know, relatively speaking, the most plausible of the possible outcomes?
Yeah. So let's assume that he died or was incapacitated. I think it also makes a difference whether he died immediately or if he's in some sort of prolonged state of incapacitation where there's a lot of ambiguity. So I think the level of ambiguity about what's happening, what's going on with the leader, matters and how we would assess the future scenarios. But I would say that at least in the near term, we would see some inertia, bureaucratic inertia in terms of people continuing to do their jobs, people showing up to their offices and showing up to their bases and showing up to their stations and basically going on with their with their day-to-day activities were. And we saw this when Kim disappeared for 40 days back in 2014 for what the regime said was ankle surgery. And then he subsequently showed up, you remember what he showed up with, you know, with the cane and he was limping. But, you know, in those 40 days, we didn't see massive troop movements or any kind of a sense that something was awry that would lead to internal collapse. So while I think that there is a resiliency to North Korea, in the near term, I think there'll be some stability. It is in the elite and others' interests for there to be stability in North Korea, because they don't want to disrupt their livelihoods and their privileges. But I think in the longer term, if there is a prolonged period of Kim's incapacitation, there would be a lot of questions about who's actually making the decisions. And that's when, as we move forward into the medium to the long term, that we might be able to glean some hedging, factions developing, alliances forming, and other activities that we wouldn't see from the outside or that we wouldn't see in the near term.
Interesting. We could go on quite a bit on this topic. It's so interesting. I think there's plenty of evidence that being number two in a dictatorship is a pretty uncomfortable position to occupy, just as Chung Sung Tech.
We're going to take a short break here to talk about Asia Society's celebration of Asian Pacific American Heritage Month throughout May. On May 18, writer, director, and producer Alan Yang joins Asia Society to discuss his latest film, Tiger Tail, on Netflix. Later this month, on May 27, author Kathy Park Hong leads a virtual book club conversation about her new book, Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning. And there's so much more. To join those conversations or see what else we have going on in celebration of Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, check out asiasociety.org/APA. That's asiasociety.org/APA. Now let's get back to the conversation.
Let's turn to the issue of the novel coronavirus. You know, the world now is horribly closing in on 4 million confirmed cases with well over 250,000 deaths. We know there were hundreds of cases in the Chinese provinces that border directly on North Korea. We know that there was very extensive air travel, train travel between China and North Korea in December and the first half of January. But North Korea, population of 25 million people, insists that it has had, you know, not a single case of COVID-19. So, Key, you know, as a physician, let alone a doctor with so much experience in North Korea, I mean, it seems implausible to a layman. But what's your best guess about what the COVID-19 experience was, and what have you seen?
Yeah, I can see why people think it's implausible. There's a pattern of that kind of, not reporting everything. But in this situation, if you look at it purely from a public health intervention standpoint, North Korea actually started to shut down their borders even before Wuhan was locked down. This was in January 20th, 21st. Flights were stopped. Tourism was stopped almost on a daily basis. And they sealed their borders pretty much, you know, towards the end of January. Remember, the next country to do a comprehensive border closure, I think, was Italy, which was 6 weeks later. And this is after they had thousands of deaths in the country. So if you look at pandemics, within the pandemic timeline, early decisions to seal borders and contain make a huge difference. So one thing, North Korea did apply it super, very quickly. The other thing is that the threat of the virus entering through the 900-mile border between China and North Korea that I had thought would be very porous, I think maybe I overestimated that. The reason is the two provinces that actually border North Korea, they never really had that many cases to begin with. There are two provinces. There was 100 cases reported. The other one was 145 cases, one or two deaths each. And both of these provinces went on semi-lockdowns very quickly. So these were controlled. So I think for those two reasons, the risk of the virus entering into the country was pretty low. I'm not saying it was zero. And the other piece of data point that we want to look at is the behavior of the North Korean government. You know, they locked down the borders pretty early. Trade was stopped. These were costly decisions for the government with economic, you know, implications. And Jung can talk more about that. But for them to start relaxing some of these measures indicates a level of confidence and an assurance that they're doing what they think is right. So I'm not going to tell you they have or they don't have COVID cases inside North Korea. I think that's debatable. What's not debatable is that the North Koreans feel like they're somewhat have dodged a bullet at this point. But I do want to make sure that we're clear on this, that they didn't dodge the bullet and they're in the safe. That's not the case. What started as an epidemic in Wuhan is a now full-blown pandemic. And the threat is actually higher now than it was before in some ways. So North Koreans are going to modulate, you know, their border policies as they go on. But at the same time, they will need to strengthen their treatment capacities, the medical countermeasures. They don't have enough. Their health system is weak. We could talk a little bit about that later. but they're doing both things at the same time, the non-medical countermeasures and medical countermeasures. And I do want to say one thing about this notion that just because North Korea asked for help, that sort of discounts the fact that they have no cases. They claim that they have no COVID cases inside North Korea. That's not the case. They're controlling the borders, but at the same time, they're trying to strengthen their health system. I think that's completely consistent.
So you talked about the countermeasures that North Korea took. So strict quarantine protocols and maybe anti-epidemic public information campaign, border closures, and so on. And I'm coming away with the impression that those likely were pretty effective. But what kind of unintended consequences would those measures have more broadly for public health in North Korea? They've got, you know, real battle with multi-drug resistant tuberculosis. They've got malaria. They've got a lot of other sort of chronic diseases. Do you see that being impacted by the tough measures?
Yeah, so the measures, so there are three parts to the measures. One is the travel restrictions, the border, to try to prevent the virus from coming in. The second is mitigation measures to reduce the transmission of virus once it's in the country. And third is strengthening their capacity to treat in case there's a surge of cases. I think the measures that they've taken as far as sealing off the borders, that has a tremendous impact on the economy, as I mentioned, and some of the humanitarian assistance that was trying to get in. For instance, the drugs for tuberculosis, they're on hold. I mean, there are other aids like food program aid, the shipments. There are, I think, thousands of containers that are currently being held at Dalian trying to get into North Korea. And much of that is humanitarian assistance. So I think that's impacting the vulnerable population, plus the economy that depended on the border trade between North Korea and China. People that are dependent on that, I think their livelihood is severely impacted. And those things can in turn impact their health.
That's interesting. Hey, Jung, what does your well-honed spider sense tell you about COVID in the DPRK?
No, I take on board Key's comments about how the risks to North Korea would have been tamped down by, you know, some of those measures that North Korea took down early, you know, put in place early. The fact that there are fewer cases in the border regions of China. I think the in terms of what's happening. So there's North Korea's measures to prevent the entry of the virus, of the coronavirus, but then there's also, so it's not just in external, it's also internal, where we've seen some reports where even domestic travel is being hampered as a result of trying to prevent people from spreading spreading within the country. There's signs of some economic anxiety in Pyongyang in terms of panic buying and some hoarding. And we saw that, you know, not just, we saw that in our own country. We saw that in South Korea and other parts where people were buying lots of things. And that was, you know, that is usually taken as a sign of this uncertain future and the government's ability to respond to certain things. And, you know, so while North Korea's measures, these lockdown measures, have probably done a great deal to try to stem the flow of the disease into the country, it's also tinged by a lot of the paranoia of the regime that it's always had, which is, you know, they want to quarantine and disinfect all of the things, the thousands of whatever container ships that are at the Chinese ports, that they want to, that this paranoia prevents the actual aid from getting in to help the, that's designed to help the regime. You know, and I agree about, with Key about that the regime is at least publicly confident that it has done this. And I think it's also political too, in that you want to have and this is not specific to North Korea either, where you want to have the theater of control, where you want to make sure and allay fears and assuage fears in your domestic population about the fact that the government has it under control, right? Kim Jong-un has had various high-level meetings. His officials have had meetings about coronavirus. At the last SPA meeting, they talked about increasing the budget. The Pyongyang hospital is also another way that they can publicly tout what the regime is doing to prevent this disease from ravaging the country. So, you know, and again, here, it's really, it's hard to decipher what's political and what's prudent and what's paranoid and what's not. And what is theater versus what's real. But I do, you know, I think all of that to say that I agree with Key, it's probably not zero as the regime is saying, but that the truth is somewhere in between. That said, you know, this is a long-term thing. And I think North Korea recognizes that the building of the hospital is the most visible recognition of the fact that this is not going to go away. But, you know, North Korea also has the benefit of being between China and South Korea, two of the countries that are doing a great job of containing the disease. So there's that residual benefit of being in between two countries that are doing pretty well on coronavirus.
Well, I want to come back to a number of those points, and whether it was, you know, political or theatrical or otherwise. You do have to admit that North Korea and North Korea's leader moved very quickly into action. And you can do a thought experiment about what the situation in the United States would have been like had there been that kind of alacrity in response.
That paranoia we saw that in 2015, Key, with the Ebola. Was that 2014 with Ebola, where they shut down the border, you know, even though Ebola was not anywhere close to North Korea? I mean, that goes to the level of, you know, the paranoia about what something like that could do to North Korea.
Both of you have touched on one of the areas that a lot of people online are interested in, which is the impact of the countermeasures to protect against COVID on North Korea's economy and on Kim Jong-un's economic agenda. So there was both the immediate countermeasures, shutting down the borders, and that has obviously stopped the kind of smuggling or the kind of trade that had been previously underway. There's also the economic consequences of a downturn in China's economy, in the global economy, and so on. Jung, do you have a read on sort of what the after effects on the economic side might be for North Korea?
Yeah, you know, Kim Jong-un admitted himself back in December at the end of last year that things were not good. And that was a huge change from when he came in with his first speech in 2012, where he said, no, you know, we're not going to have to tighten our belts anymore. But in 2019, in December of 2019, he said, we might have to tighten our belts. And so, you know, that's a big delta, I think, in terms of how Kim is seeing the economy. They weren't, you know, 2018 was a terrible year for North Korea as a result of some of the sectoral sanctions that had been put in place and the continued isolation of North Korea. 2019 was not great either, but coronavirus with the lockdowns on trade and smuggling and all of the things that it's going to do for people's ability to generate revenue for themselves to eke out a survival coronavirus comes at a terrible time for North Korea. That affects not just your average North Korean trying to have trade, you know, trade and smuggle and other items to put food on their tables, but it also affects the regime's ability to generate revenue for itself and to pay off the elite. If the elite are not making money, you know, as a result of coronavirus, then that means less revenue for the regime in terms of loyalty payments. And so across the board, coronavirus does big damage to across all segments of North Korea. But that said, you know, the wealth gap between North Koreans are huge ever since the market, ever since marketization gained momentum in the late 1990s, and with the public distribution system falling apart during the famine. Defectors in their memoirs have talked about this wealth gap, about of the haves and the have-nots, and I could see that that kind of income inequality really deepening because of coronavirus.
Interesting. So there could be some strategic ramifications and political ramifications in that respect as well. Well, here's a question that harkens back to something key that you alluded to earlier, which is medical help from overseas. North Korea has put very strict conditions on what it will accept, what it's asked for. It's wanted medical supplies, but not medical people. It rejected an offer of help from the U.S. I know that WHO, Médecins Sans Frontières, there are other organizations, and you yourself have been involved in providing medical support and assistance to North Korea more broadly, of course, than just over COVID. Could you give us a sense of kind of what sort of role foreign humanitarian or medical assistance plays in North Korea?
Right. So North Korea is not a country that's poor and wishes all donors to come and give as much aid as they can possibly give, right? They're not sort of willing recipient of all aid, and nor do they try to be. You know, they don't reach out to everybody and says, please help us. But there are very rare occasions when they'll reach out externally and saying, we need help with something. And typically it comes from, they ask organizations that have long-term relationships with, or a UN agency, because of the multilateral nature of these agencies, or their friends. So in February, mid-February, it's been now known that they actually reached out to these NGOs, UN agencies, and some other countries for assistance in dealing with the COVID-19 response. They actually reached out to US NGOs as well, direct communications. Now they were able to get some of these assistance delivered. It didn't take, it took some time because, as you know, the UN Security Council sanctions, there's an exemption process for humanitarian assistance. Now, to be fair, the Security Council Sanctions Committee has introduced new steps to speed up the exemptions process. It's 1 or 2 days now. But the fact that you have to ask for assistance in the face of an international public health emergency makes no sense to me, but that's another issue altogether. But they did ask for help, and they were getting some of these assistance. So it's been known now the Chinese sent in diagnostic test kits, the Russians sent in diagnostic test kits, and other supplies went in sometime in March. And then what they did was turned around to the US NGOs and said, hey, thanks, but I think right now we're okay. It wasn't a flat-out rejection. It was just like, you know, we're okay for the time being. And, you know, I get that. They're in negotiations with the U.S. At least, you know, I wouldn't say they're in negotiations right now, but they sat down with multiple summits. And they don't want to be, on one hand, taking assistance from the people that actually have to, you know, negotiate hard with. So I think from the U.S. side, they prefer not to take assistance if at all possible, and they'd rather take it from their allies, trusted partners.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's another question we've gotten. Dr. Park, Jung Park mentioned the wealth gap, the disparity in North Korea. Key, what about the health gap? Jung also mentioned Pyongyang General Hospital. That's a gigantic and resource intensive project underway right now by under the personal supervision of Kim Jong-un. I've heard there are sort of two North Koreas, Pyongyang, the elites, and the far-flung provinces that have it a lot worse. What's your observation, having worked and traveled in North Korea?
So there's definitely a rural-urban disparity in healthcare. I think the best piece of data that we have is the 2017 UNICEF-led multiple indicator cluster survey, and they surveyed all the provinces and Pyongyang. And I'll give you one piece of information, which is the stunting rates, right? These are for children who are short for their age. And if you look at Pyongyang, stunting rate is 20%. But you go to some of the poorer provinces, it's as high as 30%. So there's clearly data to support there's disparity, at least in health metrics, between rural and urban. I will tell you, I mean, the Pyongyang hospital is in Pyongyang, obviously. And I've treated patients in Pyongyang University Medical College, you know, hospital. And I've had patients who were actually transferred from some of the outlying provinces and worked up the referral system and to be treated at this central hospital. So there is a referral mechanism. Whether or not there are some barriers there, I don't really know, but I have personally treated patients from these provinces. But there's also a project that I think I should talk about at this point, which has to do with specifically supporting hospital services in the provinces. It's a WHO-led project. It's to scale up surgical services at the county-level hospitals in one of the provinces, not at the Pyongyang hospital. And that's going to start sometime this summer.
Okay, thank you for that. So Jung, an urgent question from YouTube has to do with your expert eye and whether you think that the purported Kim Jong-un that showed up at the fertilizer factory was actually a body double. I don't want to send us catapulting back into that sort of crazy telephone game you talked about it at the outset, although we're certainly anxious to hear your diagnosis on body doubles. But the second question has to do with what we might expect, both in terms of the sort of the politics post-COVID. Is this something that Kim Jong-un can use to strengthen and bolster his political status, not that it needs a lot of bolstering, apparently. You know, his success in keeping out COVID helps him politically. But more broadly, you know, you talk in your book about Kim's plan B, return to coercive diplomacy. Any sense of what's in store for us in the rest of 2020? This is, after all, a U.S. presidential election year.
Yeah, thanks, Danny. And thanks for the viewer who submitted that question on the body double issue. I get that question a lot. I don't know, you know, but I have no reason to not believe the Kim's pictures at the fertilizer plant. We've seen pictures of that fertilizer plant before. And so it's not cardboard boxes that were put up there to show that Kim was alive and well, this was a body double. And given the fact that Kim is so public and so his presence is, he's omnipresent in North Korea, that I think it would be hard to put in somebody there who wasn't Kim, given the ubiquity of his facial or his physical presence in all of the regime media. Where do we go from here? I don't know where we're going to go from here, but I'd say that what I worry about is that the question is COVID, is the global economic downturn, or what we would expect would be a huge global economic downturn in the coming months and years, would that change Kim's calculus at all? And I'm not sure that it would, because I think based on looking at his behavior over the past 8-9 years, is that his default position is aggression, is to even from a position of weakness to lash out, to exert at least the optics of strength and confidence, and that's something that that he might resort to. There are some, as far as we can see from analysis of satellite imagery, is that North Korea since the summits with President Trump has continued to maintain and even refurbish and renovate various missile and nuclear facilities so that they're not out of commission, as well as all of these ballistic missile tests in the past at least since May of last year are designed to improve the capabilities of various ballistic missiles. They're not just in one place. They're mobile. They're more reliable. They're more diverse. And so, despite the fact that Kim was unable to get sanctions, despite the regime's acknowledgement of some of the economic pain that they're going to be facing and are facing, the fact that they're continuing to do this suggests that that this is a priority. The weapons are a priority, and showing strength is a priority. And, you know, Kim watches us as much as we watch him. Almost certainly he's aware of questions about whether North Korea would be more contrite, would be looking inward and not be acting out because, well, of course it would invite Chinese ire or, increase sanctions. But we've seen in the past that Kim doesn't really factor into Kim's behavior, outward behavior, because for him, showing strength is as important as anything else.
That's all for this week's episode of Asia in Depth. For more, you can subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube, and check out past episodes on our show page at asiasociety.org/podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Michelle Flor-Cruz. See you next time.